I should note that District Court Judge Susan Strong is going... Is it Ms. Crisp?
Yes.
Good morning to you. You may approach. And you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Counsel. May it please the Court. My name is Elizabeth Crisp. I'm an attorney at Jacobson Orr in Kearney, Nebraska, and I represent the mother in this matter and the appellant. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. This is an appeal from the Buffalo County Court sitting as juvenile court, and we're here before you today on a granted petition to bypass. There are three issues in this case. The first is whether the mother was denied her right to due process when she was never afforded a meaningful and timely detention protective custody hearing. The second is whether the state failed to establish a necessary foundation and establish its complete chain of custody for toenail and cord blood testing. And the third is whether the juvenile court erred in adjudicating Kane. Because the issue related to the deprivation of due process, issue number one, is so severe and amounts to plain error, the relief we are seeking is a vacation of the court's order, a dismissal, and a return of Kane to his mother's full care and custody.
What would the practical effect of that be?
It'd be an outright dismissal of the state's petition, any finding by the courts, Your Honor, and Kane would be released from Health and Human Services and be placed with his mother.
And couldn't they immediately refile?
I believe the state could certainly try, Chief Justice, but whether or not the evidence that they would assert in any kind of motion for temporary custody order or in a new petition, at that point would be stale and not constitute an emergent removal situation under the juvenile code.
What is the status of the case?
The status of the case, Chief Justice, is Kane is currently placed home with his mother and father. Placement occurred on or about approximately March 12th, I believe, or a little delayed a week after that. There is still ongoing visitation and services being provided. In the juvenile court, the only hearings we're having now are status hearings approximately every day, 90 days, to ensure that visitation is going okay pending the status of this appeal. So given the issue of a deprivation of due process, the reason we believe that is so is because this court could not be any more clear in its prior precedents under Maynard T. and Carmelo G., Carmelo G. that was written and issued by this court just last June 2nd. Ex parte orders removing children from their home are granted only because of their short duration and require further action by the state. This court, in defining what a short duration is, an in re interest of RG has stated that a 14-day delay between an ex parte order and a detention hearing teeters on the brink of unreasonableness.
What was the hearing on March 1st?
The hearing on March 1st was simply a rights advisement hearing. That's in the transcript at page 24 and 25, and I'd encourage the justices, Your Honors, to look closely at that order. The state was not present at that hearing. Neither counsel for mother or father was present at that hearing. Instead, the docket shows that the clerk simply entered the courtroom and played a rights advisement video for the parents. Now, they were given their rights advisement to detention protective custody hearing. That's on the first page of that journal entry and order. But it was simply an advisement of their rights. There was no record by the court that the mother in any way, shape, or form waived her right to detention hearing.
Isn't there some record that, in fact, they did waive their rights?
I believe not, Your Honor. If you're referring to the journal entry and order dated June 21st on transcript page 68, where the court deems the detention protective custody hearing moot, I don't believe that the juvenile court should have done that or that that would prevent this court from finding a deprivation of due process. There's a couple reasons
why. What is it, then?
I think that the court placed a label on there, Your Honor, knowing that there was a violation that occurred here. I am simply appellant counsel. I was not counsel below. And reviewing this case, preparing the briefings, I found it extremely coincidental that Carmelo G. was written and released by this court, written by Justice Miller Lerman, on June 2nd. And then here on June 21st, we have a journal entry and order from the court that took up the matter in chambers without counsel, without parties present, neither mother, father, either of their counsel, and decided basically on another ex parte basis that a detention hearing was moot. I don't think that you can rectify an ex parte removal that happened in February by basically another ex parte mootness label later in June. This court has been absolutely clear that that 14-day time frame at the beginning of a case is crucial. It's the removal time where parents are deprived from their care and custody of their children. And it's required action by the state, meaning the Deputy County Attorney's Office and the juvenile court. And any acquiescence by counsel to not have any kind of detention hearing or the court setting that rights advisement hearing, Judge Justice Funk, on March 1st, there was some action by the state to make sure that the mother did not want to exercise her right to the detention protective custody hearing. So it's our belief that her due process rights were violated, that the juvenile court code and this court's opinions could not be any more clear that not having this type of a hearing results in a total indifference to the code and amounts to plain and reversible error.
Assuming that you're correct and there was no waiver, how many opportunities did your client have after that to contest the removal?
My position would be zero, and that's based on the time frame between February 17th and March 3rd, which would be that 14-day time frame in which a hearing would be held. Now, there were multiple hearings that were held in March. There was one in April and two in May being the adjudication hearings, but at no time was that defined as a meaningful hearing. Both Carmelo G. and Maynard T.
Was your client represented at that time?
She was represented at the adjudication hearings, so the two hearings in May. I believe her counsel was present in April, but she was not, or the other way around. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I had to check that journal entry and order in the record. But nowhere did the court exercise its further action that's required under Maynard T. to ensure that the mother wanted to waive or exercise her right to the detention protective custody.
Did the mother or her counsel bring it up at any time?
Not that I could see in the record, Your Honor. But I believe if we're going to place a burden on any party, that it's on the state, not the mother nor her counsel. And the reason I say that is because in the interest of Carmelo G., this court held that objections or the lack of bringing it up and the agreement and acquiescence by counsel to continue detention protective custody hearings should not penalize a parent's right to their fundamental right of due process at these types of hearings. The delay cannot simply be condoned by the parties or the court. It's a right that the mother is entitled to. If there are no further issues or question on that issue, I'd like to briefly address the toenail and cord blood testing. The foundation is applicable in adjudication hearings, and the complete chain of custody must be proven. And this serves as an elementary safeguard for every piece of evidence that comes to the court. The cord blood testing, there was no evidence whatsoever that anybody collected it, so the state didn't even start that chain of custody. And with the toenail testing, Dr. Abbas was not a sufficient witness because he had absolutely no personal knowledge of the tests in these cases. And actually, the case that the state and the guardian ad litem rely upon warn against people like Dr. Abbas that they serve as a mere conduit for testimony of other experts, that they're not closely connected in any way. Dr. Abbas was simply contacted by his customer service department after the testing had already been done.
What did the doctor review, though, in his testimony?
He simply reviewed the testing results. Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't know how that's any different if we pull Adam off the street, make him memorize the policies and procedures of the lab, and then give him a test result and say, connect the dots. I think that's what Dr. Abbas did here.
Did your client at some point in time admit to using methamphetamine?
She did on January 24th, I believe that was before baby boy was born, under entry interest of Taven. However, I don't believe that that was a direct risk of harm to her son, Kane. And it was although it was an illegal activity, that without more is not sufficient to adjudicate. If I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bizzani, good morning to you.
Okay, may it please the court. I'm Mandy Amy. I am with the Buffalo County Attorney's Office in Kearney, Nebraska. The justices here this morning have hit on a number of the arguments the state has here. With regard to this matter, and specifically Kane, as there were two children, Kane and Carter, who's the next case on the docket, Kane essentially has two parents. And at the time of the removal, he was residing with his father, Scott Wang. He did perfect an appeal. However, he failed to file any briefs. So the state's position here is simply that regardless of where we are, the adjudication should stand based on the default regarding Scott, who did fail to file a brief. He was represented throughout the beginning of the case, as was the mother. Our procedures in Buffalo County, through the eyes of the Child Initiative, essentially are that we have a pre-hearing conference. We started at 1 o'clock. We have a rights advisement video. The clerk does play that video, recorded by the judges, which was kind of entertaining to watch. However, the state does not always participate in that. They go in, they watch their video, then we come out, we have a pre-hearing conference after that, which includes their counsel, and then we have the opportunity to go in and have that protective custody hearing.
Is that what happened in this case?
It is, Your Honor.
Is there a record of that?
Your Honor, quite frankly, there should be a record of that. I believe it's on the complaining party. That's their burden to establish that no protective custody hearing ever occurred. She says it is suspect that Judge Rademacher went in and created a journal entry later. In fact, what he was doing was preparing for one of the contempt hearings and the motions for order to show cause that Ms. Pham, as guardian ad litem, had filed on the parents to get them to comply with the orders included in the adjudication, which were the drug testing and the evaluations for substance abuse. He wanted those things done so that in the time that the appeal was going, that potentially we could look at moving forward with visitations increasing and then reunification, as Ms. Christ has indicated, that has occurred because parents have finally started to comply with that testing. It did take some time and some efforts through the juvenile court. Essentially what happened that day was that the parents did attend the pre-hearing conference. They were represented throughout that, and we always appoint someone for each parent upon the filing of the petition as well as the guardian ad litem. We went into the court. We were going to go on record, and then the attorneys for the parents indicated that they were going to do a written denial and waiver, and that if after they met with their clients and talked some more, they were going to bring things in because there were pending criminal charges and they did not want to put them on the stand and take that risk of...
Let me go back a little bit to the video.
Yes.
How do we know what it said? How would it get into the record or its existence?
We worried that would be a concern when we first started doing that. I guess what we could do for future cases, and I chose not to do that now, but we could take and have that transcribed. Essentially, the judges are reading the same exact rights advisement that they do prior to an adjudication or a termination.
But that's an answer to a different question. Mine is, how do we know it exists, it occurred, and its content?
There is a journal entry that the court does and includes, and I can't remember the number of the exhibit, but they do the journal entry, including what was advised that day and who was present. So those things are in the written record.
Is the digital recording running during that period of time?
It is. The clerk does turn it on, and it was probably an error on my part not to have included that in the record for purposes of appeal. But the clerk does make sure that is done so that I think she even announces who is there, and that is where that justice printout comes from, that she does that. With regard to the...
Back to the, I think it's the June 21st entry by the judge. What does that say and what does that show?
Essentially, he was reviewing the files in preparation for another hearing that we were going to have, and he indicated that he realized we hadn't gone on record when the parents had come into the courtroom, and so he, after the rights advisement and the pre-hearing conference, he felt that he should have made a journal entry at the time of the hearing. He looked back and thought, well, we've already had our adjudication at this point, so he made a journal entry of that.
And what is the journal entry indicate?
To my recollection, he indicated that a quick hearing was held, but then he also felt that it was moot since we had heard evidence. We'd had numerous hearings where the parents had an opportunity to be heard on any of their concerns at that point, and he felt that it was moot at that point to have a detention hearing. So that's where we're at on that. I did want to reserve 5 minutes for Ms. Stamm, so apparently I've overtalked what I thought I would. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Stamm, good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Vicki Stamm, and I'm the guardian ad litem for Kane in this matter. There's only a few things. Obviously, the court is adequately aware of the record before it with regard to what happened. The thing that I think the most important is for the court to be aware of is the timing of when everything occurred. We did have, the court found there was a temporary custody order on February 17th of 2017. On February 22nd, the court, because of President's Day, did order and appoint counsel and guardian ad litem for Kane. On the 28th, Angela Lang's counsel entered a written denial of the allegations contained in the complaint. And then on the 1st, we did indeed have this pre-hearing conference. And I'm sure the court is aware of what happens at pre-hearing conferences, where the attorneys and the parties are all there and we all discuss the matters and what is going to occur. And I understand that there's not a record made of that because it's all confidential. But I did want the court to be adequately aware that we did indeed have one of those. Issues were discussed by the parties and resolutions were determined at that time. And so the court typically, as Ms. Amy pointed out, has this 1 o'clock hearing where the people go in and they listen to their rights advisement. 1:30 we have pre-hearing conference, 2:30 is when we have the detention hearing. All I can assume, Your Honors, is that the parties, Mom, Angela, talked to her attorney, Mr. Baldwin, and they determined that a hearing was not necessary because a hearing was not held that day. Obviously, we had discussions at the pre-hearing conference. So my position is twofold. Either the parents waived their detention probable cause hearing, in which if they waived it, then obviously, as the court pointed out, there were plenty of hearings. There was never, ever an objection to placement filed in this case.
Is there a written waiver in the record?
There is not a written waiver.
And we don't have a record on which an oral waiver occurred?
Absolutely not, Your Honors. We do not have any kind of, other than the journal entry of 621 done by Judge Rademacher. That's the only written journal entry with regard to what happened at that hearing, wherein he reports that the parents' attorneys came in and indicated they wanted a continuance because of discovery that was necessary to occur, because obviously this case had just started. They didn't have the information before them. So that is the only thing in the record with regard to the detention hearing.
So what are we to do without a record?
I think what you are to do without a record is that you have to make the determination that Judge Rademacher's journal entry of 621 indicates that they asked for a continuance. And if the court determines that the parents asked for a continuance of the detention hearing, that then number two, that the burden then becomes on the parent to request the next detention hearing. I'm sure this court is adequately aware of what the rules are with regard to juvenile cases and what the court's rights advisements are. And found within the journal entry on 3-1 is the rights advisements with regard to what the court will do if you feel that you are aggrieved by the court, which is allow a hearing. And as the court pointed out, from the time of February 28th, when the parents' attorneys entered their appearance in denials, until after we had the adjudication in June, there was never once an objection to placement or any kind of placement hearing held in this matter. Again, parents had plenty of opportunity to come before the court or file motions. In fact, the only motion I believe that Mom has included in the record is my motion to get pre-adjudication services done for Kane. Okay? So obviously, throughout this case, the parents were represented and they had the opportunity. They simply did not take it. They either waived it or they asked for a continuance. And then I argued to the court that it is not the state's burden then at that point to make sure that a hearing is held, that it becomes a burden on the parents who have asked for the continuance and that they have then, once they don't do anything, what can the state do at that point? The other issue, and I only want to touch on it briefly, is with regard to the doctor's testimony. And honestly, whether you find that the chain of custody is sufficient or not, the only thing as Kane's guardian ad litem that I took away that was significant from the doctor's testimony is that Kane was chronically and repeatedly exposed to methamphetamine. That, to me, as Kane's guardian, was the most important factor that the doctor testified to. Other witnesses testified with regard to the positive methamphetamine results. So there was plenty of information before the court and evidence, but that is what I want this court to take away from this as Kane's guardian litem, that this wasn't just a one-time exposure. This wasn't just I sat on a couch of somebody that used methamphetamine. He was chronically exposed to methamphetamine.
What about the chain of custody? How are we to deal with that if we're to come to the conclusion you wish us to come to?
Your Honor, I think it's unrealistic for the mother to think that anyone who touches this toenail that was taken can come and testify. The doctor testified with regard to the procedures that the laboratory does with regard to the testing, and that those procedures were indeed followed. And so I think that you're putting an unreasonable burden on the state to have to bring in the 10 people that possibly touched this toenail. The doctor testified that everything was complied with, that there were no issues or concerns whatsoever, and so I think that a sufficient chain of custody was indeed proven. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Is there time for rebuttal? 52 seconds, Ms. Crisp.
Every second, Chief Justice. Thank you. Directly to your point, Chief Justice, that if it's not in the record, what should you do? If it's not in the record, it's as if it never happened. The state had a full opportunity to supplement the record.
Did you have some burden here to create the record?
I had that burden, and I perfected the record with every filing that there was. As far as Mrs. Stamm's position that the burden that transfers to the parents, nowhere in in re interest of DMV, nowhere in in re interest of Carmelo, nowhere in in re interest of Maynard T, is a burden ever placed on the parents.
Did you ask for a bill of exceptions from the very first hearing?
I did not, Your Honor.
So we don't really know. We don't have a certification from the court reporting personnel whether that record exists or not.
Outside of the journal entry and order that states what rights were read, there's no verbatim of the video in the record, no. So I would submit on that basis and ask the court reverse. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So now we will go to in re interest of Carter L. And the state is appealing this matter, so Ms. Amy, you may approach us again.
Your Honors, with regard to this matter, I feel that in the Kane case, the judge got it right. And the reason for our appeal in Carter is because if one child is exposed,